If you want to take part in the Christmas card stream, now is the last chance for your card to arrive in time. Don't delay.
And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome to the 8th night of Millennial 2025. Let me just get that right. Yes, it is. And another 4 interviews tonight. In 2 hours it'll be Richard IV and then the Delphica Society and then Red Ice. But first I have UK Column, and this is a hotly anticipated stream each year, so I'm glad that we're going to do another installment. And it's I don't think we need to describe UK Column in great detail, but Brian, could you just give a brief introduction to UK Column for anyone who isn't familiar with it?
Thank you very much for that. Well, UK Column is a media organisation, and we are very, very pleased to say that next year, it's actually January next year, we will have been going for 20 years. We started with one A4 sheet. We developed that with a lot of help from very generous and loyal supporters into a full-size newspaper, which we published for a number of years. And altogether, over the time that we put those newspapers out, we put out it was over 900,000. That was... we did aim for monthly, but it was difficult to keep that going. But nevertheless, we put out a newspaper. And then eventually, when Mike Robinson joined the team, Mike was of the opinion that we should be looking at video and streaming online. And so Mike is the man who not only got stuck in with the newspaper, but converted us to doing an online streaming news. And we give the news 3 times a week, plus interviews, plus we've done some documentaries. We also host symposia on a variety of subjects, and those have all been very well received. But essentially, the media we're putting out is challenging the mainstream narrative, and in particular covering subject areas that clearly the mainstream media doesn't want to cover. So we're out there to poke a big stick into the government and the globalist government, the rules-based international order, to ask questions, to dig, lift stones, and do the things that, as I say, the good old BBC and the other media won't.
All right, excellent. Mike, since it's your first time on Millennial, your first appearance, would you like to give your perspective on UK Column and your involvement with it?
Yeah, I joined in 2008. So Column had been going for a couple of years, or year and a half, 2 years by that stage. And I mean, we have developed a huge amount over the years. I mean, we're doing 3 days a week news at the moment. Actually, for quite a few years, we were doing 5 days a week news, but that didn't give us that really was a hamster wheel, and didn't give us the opportunity to sort of develop the business side of things. And we've done that. There's been lots of changes. Many more faces on with us now than there were then. It is fun sticking it to the man, if that's what we're doing.
All right. Okay, then. Well, we'll get into the first topic, and that is the general state of the nation. We're talking about the UK, but I'm sure this will touch on other countries. But Ben, how would you approach this topic and summarise the state of Britain in 2025?
Divided, deconstructed, being pulled apart piece by piece, reconstituted by people who don't have the nation's best interests at heart, to be honest with you. They've taken over all of the kind of primary institutions, political, all the main political parties, civil service, the military, the intelligence agencies, the police, certainly the health system is an epicenter of this stuff. All of the major multinational corporations that operate in this country, they're all essentially working against the nation and its people, and trying to get rid of fundamental things like trial by jury, for example. You know, things that have been around for 800 years plus, 1,000 years, and they're just kind of tossing it all on the bonfire and trying to migrate us onto this global system that is technocratic, dictatorial, and deeply like inhumane and cruel, really, in the way that it operates, but under the guise of compassion and kindness and empathy. And it's all just a total mess, actually, I would say. The mainstream of the country. There's a lot of other things going on as well, but that's probably a good starting point.
Brian, I think that the trial by jury, not many people have talked about it on Millennial this year so far, and I'm a bit surprised, because to me this is a very important and fundamental change to our national life. Would you like to give your opinion on why that's happening, why they're apparently, and this is, I mean, I know it's David Lammy who's doing it, but I think we can assume that he's just acting on orders from other people, why they're doing this?
Well, I think it's a very simple explanation as to why, because the simple answer is, if you get rid of the jury, you are left with a judge appointed by the means by which judges are appointed. So we can say the Judicial Appointments Committee. Who appoints them, we don't know. The UK column has tried to find that out over a number of years. So it's difficult to find out who actually appoints the judges. But if we get rid of juries, we're left simply with an appointed judge controlling the court. And that brings in any failures, any biases, any political biases or personal biases, or even criminal biases that may afflict the judges. And for me, the best measure of where this actually goes is if you go inside a family court hearing, and that's it, a hearing that has the power to take people's children away from mums or dads or marriages or couples, there is a single judge who is accountable to nobody else, operating in a court without a jury, usually without the press, and he is making decisions over whether children can and cannot stay with their parents. So that can be described as a star chamber if you look back historically to see what that means, but essentially it means a court that's simply operating for the king. If we look at who is now pushing through this removal of the jury, of course Lammy is one person, but we got to look to Lord Leveson. And the reason that this retired judge is of great interest is that, of course, he was the man who was heavily involved in all of the attack on the media.
The Leveson inquiry.
Through the Leveson inquiry. Yeah, thank you. So his background there is absolutely being used by the state, usually under the title that he's independent. But we watched him very closely as he was at work through the Leveson inquiry, where it was clear to us that what was actually happening was, first of all, a destabilization of the press and media, and it was ultimately moving towards greater control, and not least by making even mainstream media fearful of what they could do and could not do, what they could say and could not say, because if they got it wrong, there was going to be a regulator who was going to fine them or hold them to account. Now, I just add that, that's turned out, in my opinion, to be softer than where they wanted to go, but nevertheless, it has significantly degraded free speech in the press. So Leveson's got that background, but he's the person who was chosen to do the independent review into the proceedings in the criminal courts. And in the report that he produced a few months ago, he uses the excuse of COVID, because it was in COVID that built up the backlog, COVID and lockdown built up the backlog of court cases. And the backlog of court cases is now apparently so significant that the only way of dealing with it is to get rid of jury trials, because they're time consuming. And if we just have a judge in court for the simpler cases, then we can get people through the system and regain control of the court system. Now he's produced the latest report, but even in his report, he's referring back to other reports that were heading in the same direction, dating from 2015. And then, of course, we have young Lammy, who was also campaigning for this. Initially, he was doing it from the wings, because he'd written material about changes in the courts on his own. But now it's clear that he's being brought under the wing of Leveson in order to get these changes through. But what's the danger? The danger is you are going to be in court with a judge. You don't even know how that judge was actually appointed. But that judge is going to decide your fate. And what I think we can be certain of is that although they've started out the new plan saying, well, it's only going to be more minor offences, where it will simply be a judge, this is the thin end of the wedge. And their ultimate intention is to get rid of the jury trial, because, of course, this is a unique characteristic of English law. And we've only got to go over the channel to see the difference with European law, where invariably it is a politically elected judge who's going to sit in judgment of you. And last bit before I hand it over to whoever's going to speak is that the other thing is that you can see the legislation changing, whereby it's becoming more and more dangerous to be challenging the government or to challenge political policy and legislation. And if you're now getting judges who are going to adjudicate on those sorts of cases, it means the accused is going to be even more vulnerable, because there's not a jury of right-thinking men and women who are going to say, this person said something which upset somebody on social media. And the idea that they're in a court being charged is ridiculous. We're going to throw this hearing out. So the judge is very dangerous. And the last bit is that when you get rid of the jury, you also get rid of jury nullification, which is the the nullification is the jury has the right to find somebody not guilty of a charge, even though they broke the law in carrying out whatever act they did. So the jury is left with an overall ability to make a human and moral judgment. Yes, they broke the law, but we are still going to find them not guilty. And that has enormous power in challenging bad law or unfair laws that are brought in.
So that would just be gone because judges wouldn't use that. They wouldn't invoke that. You can't have judge nullification, I guess.
Can we just add to that? Because you raise a really good point there, that the judges are actually hostile to this to such an extent that they do not want juries to even know that the jury has that ability. And what we are seeing more frequently now is that judges would respond to any attempt by a jury to move towards nullification as sort of treason within the court, and they're getting very aggressive about it. So they want that stamped out, because ultimately it gives the ordinary man and woman, the jury, the power to directly challenge the power of judges in court.
Right, okay. Ben or Mike, would you like to say anything about this? Because I do think this is a very important issue for Britain this year. Mike? Hold on, I'll unmute you. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is the end of a process, because a process has been going on actually for a very long time. Britain originally used grand juries to decide whether a case was to be brought to court in the first place. I think the last time a grand jury sat was in the 1930s. Justice was local. A grand jury of 24 would hear the evidence against someone and make a decision about whether there was even a case to answer. And then, of course, that went to trial with the petit jury. But the grand juries have been replaced with Crown Prosecution Service, so everything gets centralized, it gets controlled, and local community no longer has a say in the judicial process. So this is something that has been going on for a very long time. And of course, although we're now at this stage, we've seen the removal of juries for more and more types of offences over the last couple of decades. But Leveson isn't only looking at juries, he's also looking at other aspects of the criminal justice system, how to make the court system more efficient. And he's certainly a big proponent of increasing use of technology. And inevitably, these days, that means increasing use of AI. So AI is going to be initially rolled out to improve the administrative efficiencies of the courts, they claim. And of course, this is part and parcel of this, aside from the digital ID aspect of the mistaken, in inverted commas, prisoner releases, also the digitization of courts and prison records, and the automation of data going from the courts to the prisons and so on, which is supposedly going to completely rectify the mistakes that are being made within the prison service. Where that ends, of course, it isn't clear absolutely, because Leveson is still working on that side of things as well. This is part of a process that's been going on for many years, but we're coming towards a point where from the individual's point of view, the individual that might be on the receiving end of an increasingly totalitarian-minded regime, as we start to see the increasing political prosecutions for people having opinions or for people expressing opinions, that becomes a pretty dangerous scenario.
That is very ominous, all of that you've just said. What can any of you speculate as to the possible, and I don't want to fearmonger here, I'm just wondering, the possible uses of AI in the legal, in the judicial system? I mean, what does that mean when we say that they could be expanding use of AI?
Well, the ultimate endpoint, you're talking judge, jury, and executioner. Like it's a total centralized technocratic control of human existence via the algorithm. That's ultimately what they're driving towards. And just to build on, you guys might want to come back to that, but I did want to just build on a couple of things that Brian and Mike had just pointed out there, which is one of the things that UK Column has always been very good at is focusing at the people that aren't in the immediate foreground, but they're a level above or a couple of levels above and slightly behind the scenes. Because when you talk about this issue of trial by jury, most people think about David Lammy, because it's been in the press over the past month or so that Lammy is at the forefront of this thing. And he's taking all the flak for it. But the fact of the matter is, it's got nothing to do with him, really. I mean, he's spoken on it previously, as I think Michael Bryan pointed out, right? But actually, this is Leveson. This is Brian Leveson. This is coming from the top of the judiciary. And Leveson's a particularly interesting character for the reasons that we've already pointed out. But also, he's the Investigatory Powers Commissioner. And he's currently in his second term, coming towards the end of his second term. And he was the Investigatory Powers Commissioner overseeing the powers that the police and the intelligence services and any State Department, you know, whether it's, DWP or the Gambling Commission or whatever it might be, he oversees what powers they have to investigate citizens for crimes. And in 2023, they brought in this thing called the Investigatory Powers Act, criminal conduct, which basically has made it legal for the state to commit crimes against citizens in the pursuit of their investigations. So not only is he going off trial by jury, he's also been in position while they have overseen and introduced legislation which allows the state to commit crimes. So this is a total breakdown in inversion of what you would expect a functioning legal system to do. And it's been overseen by someone who the vast, overwhelming majority of people in this country have never heard of him. They've got no idea who that is. And it all gets pumped into sort of, you know, Lammy. And you know, he might be the fall guy for a lot of the immediate pushback on this, because it is a lot of pushback on it from all sides of society. But I can already see the seeds being sown in certain places of how they're going to try and sell this at the next election. Because what they're saying is that, you can't go after trial by jury without a democratic mandate, right? And so where I think this will head to is that at the next election, maybe it's Farage, for example, will say, well, we got to do it because of illegal immigration. In order to clear the illegal immigration backlog or some other hot topic like that, we've just got to do it for a short period of time, but we'll sort it out and we'll come back to it later. And obviously that will never happen. So it's Lammy's one thing, but it's a much bigger program of activity operating over a much longer period of time, as Mike pointed out. And actually, the people really pulling the strings, no one has any visibility of them at all, really.
Yeah, I think it's important not to get hung up on the fact that it's David Lammy as the face of this.
Yeah.
Because people love to make fun of him and all that. And yes, it's fun, but it's trivializing an extremely important issue and also missing the point of who's actually doing it. He is nothing. He's a moron.
Exactly. And then if he gets taken out of office, people think, oh, well, the problem's gone away. It's like, no, the problem's not gone anywhere. The problem's still very much there. That's just a piece of flimflam that they use to distract your attention.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything else to be said about the use of AI in law, in the judiciary? Brian?
Something which I think is particularly pertinent to parts of the discussion tonight is that when you look at Leveson's report, his independent report into the criminal court and effectively juries, on the front cover of that document, he has a number of quotes to do with the law. And I found it particularly interesting that the first quote you come to, you read the title of the document, and then the first quote to your right is actually the Talmud. And Lord Leveson is Jewish, on the front of his report is a quote from the Talmud, but all the other quotes, I think there's four, so I think it's five quotes in total. The other quotes are not religious based at all. So he's making a statement on the front cover. Now, is he promoting his religion or the fact that he's Jewish? But I found myself thinking, well, this is very interesting, because if in his mindset he's got justice by the judges going through his head, what's happened to the Christian component of law in this country and trial by jury? Because there's no Christian quote. There's no quote from the Quran, for that matter. Now, this could be an oversight, or it could be a simple thing, and they would say, well, we shouldn't be concerned about this. But I do not believe that the quote appearing where your eye immediately goes in a Western country, you move from left to right, that quote is there, I believe, because it's saying something. And I wonder, because I don't know, but I wonder whether in his head he is actually moving towards a system of justice which is actually foreign to this country.
Yeah, it reminds me of the concept of the rabbi who is in charge and shapes the thinking of all below him. That idea of the circle, the learning circle. I don't know what the term is, but the seniority and what would be the word, imperviousness of the rabbi as a force in the community, that seems to be what they're, this getting rid of the jury, that would mold the judge into a figure of total authority yeah. over how this case is dealt with and what becomes of the people involved in it. All right, so I don't know if there's any more to be said about this. Do any of you want to say any more about the trial by jury issue?
Just to add to the AI bit, I suppose that the most likely first candidate for the use of AI in the judicial system would be Northampton Bulk Processing Center, which is where speeding fines and car related or motoring offences are mainly processed. I mean, that the rollout of AI more generally is still fairly early on in its discussion, so we have to wait and see where that's going to go ultimately and how much pushback there might be from the general public. But the other thing you said, you mentioned there was the word fear at some point in a couple of minutes ago, and you know, I would just make the point that in highlighting what they're doing, we shouldn't be viewing that with fear and trepidation. We should be looking at how we can actually resist the policy agenda and the direction of travel, and we can't do that if we're just worried about stuff all the time. We've got to be a bit more willing to. I mean, public opinion is largely what they require in order to continue pursuing these policies, but most people are disengaged. So it's a matter of really just trying to educate people, I think, and doing so in a way that doesn't, at least gives them some idea that they can beat these agendas and they don't need to be afraid of them.
Yeah, it's I completely agree, but I think it's important to be, in order to mount any sort of resistance of this stuff, you have to be well resourced, and otherwise, if it's both with knowledge and with probably funding, otherwise it's you against a system, in this case the judicial system, which is extremely powerful and extremely well resourced and knows the game very thoroughly, far more thoroughly than any layman does. So I think I certainly take the point, but I think that there's a danger of being blasé and sort of gung-ho in trying to take on a system. You have to be you have to know what you're doing. And this is why I think it's very important that we have, in the dissident community, we have lawyers, people who are actually involved in this and know it well, and have connections in that community, and are able to map the territory for us to some extent.
I mean, what you say there is right to a certain extent, but if you don't have, as an individual, the resources, and then you need numbers, and so it is a bit of a numbers game. And just to give a very brief example, a number of years ago, there was a guy in Plymouth here who was challenging council tax, he wasn't refusing to pay, but he didn't feel that he was getting what he was deserving from the council, and so he was challenging them on this. But anyway, the point is, the particular year that he was doing this, the first round of court cases to create the bulk payment orders that the council was looking for from the magistrates' court. We went to because he decided he was going to offer some kind of defence in the magistrates' court, and so we, Brian and I, went to watch what was happening. And the first thing we discovered when we went into the magistrates' court in Plymouth was that there were council staff there in the foyer outside the courtroom, and their job was to try to prevent people from going into that room, because they were going to try and arrange payment plans with anybody that actually turned up to try to offer a defence. But there were something like 1,500 people on that on the list that were due to be receiving orders from the court to pay. Now, if those 1,500 people had all turned up to that courtroom that day, no business could have been done, because basically the system would have been overwhelmed right there and then. And so, you know, we may not have the financial resources to pursue big cases, but if we can organize ourselves and get sufficient numbers of people standing up to whatever policy it happens to be, the system will collapse under the weight of the opposition. I think that's something we should never forget.
Yeah. Certainly. There, another thing, to get back to the broader issue of the state of the nation, another thing that I thought was very significant this year was the asylum debacle. I wrote an essay about it on Substack. People can find it there. It was released by the Defence Secretary, the Labour Defence Secretary, that his predecessor and the Conservative government had set up a secret scheme to get people out of Afghanistan Afghans who had done work for the British government as part of the war in Afghanistan. They'd helped the army, they'd helped the government. And these were interpreters, messengers, that kind of thing. And so they, once the Allies withdrew from Afghanistan and the Taliban regained control of the country, took it over, these people were now very vulnerable, apparently. And it's ambiguous whether they were in much danger at all, because the Taliban by that time had new enemies, new people to be concerned with. And it was stated that they weren't concerned with the old collaborators with Britain. I don't know how true that was. But either way, it seems to me that it's actually, I think it's kind of ridiculous, because to treat them as if, to treat these collaborators as if they've done us a favor, when in theory, at least, we were doing them a favor by trying to improve their country. And that's the line. I mean, I don't think we were trying to improve their country, but that's the line, that we were there to help them. So it seems ridiculous that we are then indebted to them when we were trying to help their country in theory. But either way, that's the line. We are indebted to them, so we have to give them safety. We have to reward them for taking the risk of collaborating with us. And that means we have to bring them to Britain. We can't put them in some other Muslim country. We've got to bring them here. And that means, in turn, that we've got to put up with whatever they might do here in terms of criminal behavior. And we've got to look after them forevermore. And it also means that we've got to look after up to, I think, 20 of their relatives. So for every interpreter, there could be easily up to 20 people who did nothing to help the British government, but nonetheless they're connected to someone who did, so they get to have a life for free on the British taxpayer for the rest of their lives. So it's so crazy in so many ways, and yet it happened. And what's more, it happened expressly without the knowledge of the British public. It was expressly kept from the British public. There was not just an injunction, but a super injunction. And in fact, there was a global super injunction, Contra Munda, which apparently was the first of its kind ever. So it was an astonishing thing when it was revealed by the, I've forgotten his name now, but it was revealed in Parliament earlier this year. I thought it was an amazing story. The levels and depths of treachery here against the British people are eye-watering. Which of you would like to take this topic?
Do you want to go, Mike?
I'm not sure where to start with it. I think where we need to start with this is, if we're looking at the migration issue, quite a lot of the migration that we're seeing into Britain, whether it's through schemes like the one you're describing or whether it's through irregular migration in small boats, a lot of that has come from countries that we have been carrying out some kind of regime change operation or some kind of warfare. And it seems to me that if we're going to deal with the migration issue, the first thing we've got to do is deal with our foreign policy in general. And, we have had no business I'm not only talking about, by the way, wars that we obviously announced that we were directly going to be involved in, like Iraq, but also insurgencies like Syria, insurgencies like Boko Haram, or Islamic extremism, which we are funding and arming and have been for decades. That's where we got to start. I mean, for me the issue of these people being brought here is not one of the fact that they're here. It's one of why were we even in a position in the first place where this was likely to be an outcome, we're playing games in the world which are destroying people's lives. I'm not talking about the British people here. I'm talking about the British state and British state apparatus. The fact of the matter is that the British people are now reaping the rewards of the activities of their government over many, many years. This situation isn't going to be dealt with. The people, if we think that by having stronger border controls that the pressure is going to suddenly just stop, that people are going to stay in France or whatever, that's not the solution to the problem. And focusing on the migrants themselves isn't the answer to the problem. We've got to be looking at the policy that's causing people to move, and starting there, because otherwise you're just treating symptoms. And the disease, which is this occupying power, which is in our government and in our deep state, and it's not just the United Kingdom, it's Europe and the United States as well. If that isn't dealt with, then these types of problems don't go away, no matter how much people protest give verbal opposition to the policies. So I think that's where I'd start with that.
I completely take the point that this is really about a malaise or a miasma in our government. But my point by talking about the Afghani asylum debacle is that it was a debacle because it underlines, well, first of all, so we went to help them. We were involved in them. That doesn't mean that we should bring them over here and thus endanger the public.
Did we go there to help them? Is that why we went there?
Of course I don't think that. I'm saying that that's the line. But the point is, by endangering the British public, that shows that the British government is not concerned with the British public. It was what's his name? I've forgotten the politician's name. Sorry, Ben, you're trying to speak.
Robert Jenrick. Is that what you're talking about?
Not Robert Jenrick, although he was involved. It was a Jewish conservative minister. I've forgotten what his name was.
Shapps? Shapps?
That's it, yes, Grant Shapps.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reason I mention all of this, and I sort of zoom in on this particular scandal, is because people have this idea that the British government, at least in theory, should be primarily concerned with the British nation and the British public, the British people. And it illuminates that it's really not. And it's some other type of entity now, which is actually concerned with geopolitical, international, globalist projects. And the British public are, if anything, just a tax cash cow for it to undertake those projects.
Yes. And that's not new. So the thing that people, I think a lot of people think is that... this is a recent development, but I think this has probably been going on for centuries. It's just that the attacks that used to happen elsewhere are now being, and the same tactics as well, right, are being deployed against us, whereas before they were being deployed against other people. And that's for many reasons. Part of it is to do with things like trying to get rid of trial by jury, for example, because if you can destabilize the existing society and break it down while also at the same time bringing in lots of people who are not from that society and don't understand its history or the fundamental rights that it's based on, then it's much easier to get rid of those annoying things that are stopping you from doing whatever it is that you want to do. And that's the interesting thing about that. I think it was called for 1 million people as well, wasn't it? So we're not talking trivial numbers. It was a huge number.
Huge number of people.
Yeah, and that's just one thing, right? So this is, and basically the way I think about it, they've kind of booby-trapped the country, right? There are these heinous ticking time bombs all over the place. And just that policy alone, right? It might be the case, we don't know this, but it might be the case that when Blair helped Bush and et al., the coalition of the willing to go and destroy Afghanistan and Iraq. Maybe this was the plan all along. Maybe they thought, maybe they knew they were going to do this. Maybe this was part of their 25-year demoralize, deconstruct, and destroy the country agenda. Who knows? But it would have made sense if it was, because it's certainly helping. And who knows what's going to happen with that particular instance over the coming months and years? We don't know.
Yeah. One thing that somebody put to me that they suggested I ask you is, hold on, I'll see if I can find the exact wording for you. But it related to this and what Mike was just saying, that the British police, for example. Hold on a second. That the British police is now a corporation, and it's not an organization as such. It's now a company with a remit. And again, it doesn't really have much to do with protecting the British public. Now, we hear statistics about that crimes aren't investigated anymore, let alone solved, let alone the criminals brought to justice, mm-hmm. let alone it a realistic justice. And we also hear about programs in place to diversify the British police, to make them have all sorts of concerns that your stereotypical policeman of 50 years ago would never even have heard of. And that's just one institution in society. One of you mentioned the NHS earlier. I think Mike first, would you like to take this on board, this idea that the British state and its institutions are no longer, haven't been for some time, what they are ostensibly?
I think there's a lot of discussion to be had about that, but I don't think it even matters. It matters in a certain sense, but just to give one example, because what I think most people are recognizing now is that the institutions of the state, no matter how they're constituted, are giving a good impression of attacking their own people. And I suppose the one example of this is in military doctrine. And I just mentioned this quite a bit. We've talked about this on our news program quite a bit, but it's worth just reminding ourselves, because I think it was the 2018 Defence Review, or I think it was about 2018 anyway, they introduced this term, the integrated operating concept. And one of the things that they said, now they claim that they've dropped this concept in June this year, but in fact, if we listen to what the head of MI6 said yesterday or the day before yesterday, clearly they may have dropped the term, but they haven't dropped the policy. And basically what that said was that as far as the military is concerned, as far as the Ministry of Defence is concerned, there is no safety at home, that they are viewing the British people as much of a threat as abroad, and operating at home is no longer a safe thing for them. I think this is a very dangerous direction for any state, any government to go in, where they are viewing the general public as being a threat. In a sense, they should view the British public as being a threat from the point of view of their own account, of being accountable for their own actions. But this is something different, because this is military doctrine. So they're saying that the British public are potentially a threat to them and what they're doing. And so they're going to use potentially any sanction, up to including the military, as against their own people. And so, you know, we are being so heavily propagandized by the state. We're being arrested by the state for expressing views and opinions, never mind actually taking any kind of direct action or protest. Our right to protest is being systematically stripped away from us. We've already talked about the jury issue. Our right to speak freely is being taken from us on a daily basis now. I'm sure most people recognize the fact that we are being directly everything that happened during COVID time demonstrated how far that they were willing to go at that stage. If, as it looks like, we are heading towards, whether it's real or not, that we're heading towards being on a war footing, if we thought that the Coronavirus Act and the emergency powers that the government took in order to deal with that so-called crisis, if we thought that was bad, and the restrictions that were placed on people were bad over those couple of years, if we're on a war footing, it becomes even worse. And once we are formally on a war footing, the ability to speak, the ability to criticize, the ability to hold any institution to account is going to be even more curtailed than we've seen in the past. So, you know, I think at the heart of this, we've got to recognize that the migration issue is, let's put it this way, the British state at the moment is using the term hybrid warfare quite a lot with respect to Russia, this is what they're doing, and they're doing it not just to in other countries, they're doing it here to us. So they're bidding us over the head with all kinds of crises, and migration is one of them, but it's a whole host of other areas as well, and keeping people as destabilized as possible, and as feeling fearful, feeling that the world is increasingly chaotic, because while people feel that way, they can't offer an effective opposition or effective resistance. So, you know, this is all part of this idea that the government seems to have increasingly, that they need to put people down as as quickly as they can at the moment.
Yeah, and they have a whole range of ways to do that as well, which is quite unnerving. Okay, so let's get to that matter of war with Russia, because that does seem to be, they're laying the ground for it. It started about a year and a half ago now. About 2 years ago. I remember writing about it at the start of last year. And that was when there were the first rumblings that some general said, we have to think about this possibility, maybe bring back national service in preparation for it, and so forth. And now again, it's resurged again several times, but now in quite a big way. It seems like they are, and you see this in European or Western European politicians as well, the EU. There's this sense that war with Russia is sort of inevitable. Retrospectively, is how the prelude to World War I is talked about, that it was just sort of inevitable. This had to happen, that these tensions had to be explored and lived out so that some resolution could be arrived at. I don't know how true that is. And here and now, it doesn't seem right that we have to go to war with Russia in order to reach some kind of resolution. It seems like this is a conscious choice. This is being made to happen. It could be resisted, but they want it. Which of you would like to take that? Brian? Ben? Right, Brian.
I'll start it, if I may, because I just want to drop a concept in for the audience, and that is that if you go back into the European Union project, a statement which appears quite frequently, and it has huge meaning, is the European Union project from the Atlantic to the Urals. Now, that's a baseline statement for the whole building, the whole establishment of the European Union, from the Atlantic to the Urals. So that statement declared absolutely openly that Russia, at least up into the Urals, was to be subsumed into the European project. And of course, taking that huge chunk of Russia, Western Russia, into the European Union also meant, of course, that Ukraine was going to be swallowed up into the European Union project. And although we saw many years ago that relationships with the Russians were so good, there was talk at one stage of the Russians even coming into NATO. There was even talk about Russia being able to, may not come into the European Union, but at least significantly engage with the European Union. But that never happened. And of course, the moment it became clear that the Russians were able to survive the breakdown of the Soviet system, which without doubt, or I'll say in my opinion, the breakdown of the Soviet system happened with the help and connivance of the West. And what was the West doing? It was stripping away Russia's power, but also the hope was that there would be enough turbulence inside Russia that the West could simply move in and control and take over Russia. That did not happen. And you could also say part of the reason it didn't happen is because there were people manipulating and controlling behind the scenes who perhaps had enough foresight to select Putin as the leader who's now in post. But they did not succeed in taking control of Russia. But the baseline for the project was that the European Union would be in control of the European landmass from the Atlantic to the Urals. And so that, to me, was the ticking time bomb, that it was only a matter of time before they had to have another go at actually causing a conflict which was capable of destabilizing Russia. And we had, Mike, you might be able to help me out here, but the date of that RAND publication, in which they openly discussed various ways of destabilizing Russia and for conflict to be unleashed in Ukraine. That was part of the plans that were discussed. So we've now got that conflict. And what was the hoped agenda? That they were going to be able to use the Ukrainians in order to create conflict on the borders with Russia, which was going to eventually drag Russia down. Russia was not going to be able to operate in a military sense, because at the start of the conflict, actually its military forces in the West were quite weak. And also they knew that with a massive economic attack, the so-called sanctions attack, they were hoping to bring down the Russian economy. And they tried all those tricks. And not only did it not work, but what's come out of it is the Russians have demonstrated that they are stronger than the whole of NATO and the European Union countries not involved. They're stronger than the whole lot combined. And this has been a huge shock. But can the West now walk away? Well, no, because they've created this whirlpool and it's now sucking them in. They've got to win. But the reality on the battlefield is, of course, the Ukraine is not winning. What can the European Union do? They can only drive up the cry for war. And one of the key things the war always gives a state, as Mike's intimated, is extra control over its own citizens. But that's where I would, you know, for your audience, this simple statement. What was the project about? It was taking control of the whole European landmass right the way up to the Urals, which means that Western Russia was gone.
And Brian's talking about the European Union there, but I think it's very important to keep in mind that the cheerleader for this in the last decade or so has absolutely been Britain. So, you know, right at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict, it looked like there was going to be some kind of effort to have negotiations. Boris Johnson put the kibosh on that. This goes back actually quite a number of years, but let's stick with the last decade or so. The Foreign Office established what they described as the Counter Disinformation and Media Development Programme. It was led by, at that time, it was set up by a guy called Andy Price. And it was using conflict stability and security fund money to do a number of things. One of the things that it did is it set up a project called the Integrity Initiative through an NGO called the Institute for Statecraft. And the Integrity Initiative was a propaganda operation, which included journalists, British journalists, included foreign journalists as well, but it included MI6 officers. I think there were 56 of those in that organization. And its job was to make sure that there was a persistently anti-Russian narrative running through all the mainstream press in Britain. The same Andy Price was involved with the propaganda around the so-called poisoning of Sergei Skripal and Yulia Skripal, and then the death of Dawn Sturgis later on. If anybody is interested in understanding a little bit of the problems with the whole Skripal poisoning narrative, I would just urge you to go to the UK Column website and have a look at a recording of a live event that we held in Salisbury last Thursday, because that's quite eye-opening if for anybody that isn't familiar with the story and the questions around that story. So we had other types of propaganda like the Russia report that was written by the Intelligence Select Committee, and so on. So we've had this persistent, very coordinated propaganda campaign building an idea in everybody's minds that Russia is A, something to be feared, that Russia is determined to attack us, that Putin is some modern equivalent of Hitler. And none of those things is true. And even to the point where, you know, in popular culture, people just simply lie. I mean, for example, last week, Putin made a statement that was obviously in Russian. The translation of it was very clear. He made a very clear statement. "I have no desire to attack Europe," is what he said in a nutshell. But then on "Have I Got News for You" last Friday, Ian Hislop said that, and Putin has said he wants to attack Europe. So it was just an absolute outright lie. And so this is what the British public have been bombarded with for 10, 15 years now, to the point where we've seen this, you know, fairly majority support for Ukraine, people waving Ukraine flags and so on, at least at the beginning of the conflict, and continuing support, or at least no major opposition to Britain's determination to keep this conflict going.
I certainly agree that at the start of the conflict, for the first 6 months, support for Ukraine was feverish in Britain, among the British public. It certainly seemed that way. And I remember just hearing from ordinary people that Putin was a maniac, for example. And they'd heard that in the media. They'd absorbed that from the media. But it seems to me that at this point, I mean, it's a few years on now, and it seems to me that the British public are much less interested in this. I don't think they trust Zelensky. I think he just seems, and this kind of thing matters when we're talking about public perception, he just seems untrustworthy and shitty. And Russia, the Putin just isn't quite villainous enough as a persona for them to buy into it. And the reason I mention all this, because you might say that public perception just doesn't matter, and maybe it doesn't. But the reason I mention all this is, if they did try to go to war with Russia, how many of the British public would join the army, would enlist? Because presumably they're doing all of this, at least partly, because they need public acquiescence, but they also need public participation in the war effort. So if the British public aren't going to do it, then what's going to happen? Ben, you're chomping at the bit. What do you think?
There's a few things there, but the whole thing's hot air, is what I think. Like, it basically exists in formal statements from public institutions. I mean, the one that we saw on UK Column News this week, the one that stood out was the current head of MI6 giving a speech, an awful speech. She clearly hadn't written, and, you know, there weren't her words. It was poorly delivered, and, you know, it sounded like, it was like Starmer speaking, right? It's just bureaucrat. You're a bureaucrat. There's no blood, there's no life, there's no energy there at all. You don't believe what you're saying yourself. And yet you expect him to carry the country into a war. Are we actually sure about this? You know, think about what that would actually have to look like. And think about what that would actually mean. I mean, I'm not a military man, but I think it's probably fair to say that the Russian army right now is the most fearsome fighting force on Earth. Like, is there anyone else who could come close in terms of battle-hardened experience and the integration they have between their forces and, what, 1.5 million standing army? And we think we're going to go to war with them for what? You know, well, we're how many thousands of miles away are we from the Russian border anyway? So this idea that Britain needs to step in and fight Putin, it's just ludicrous, actually, when you put it under any kind of scrutiny.
Yeah, this is the other part of it. There's the public participation in the war, but then there's also the armed forces. British politicians seem to be eager for war with Russia, same with the EU politicians in different countries. And yet it seems to me that war with Russia is simply not feasible because we just don't have the military resources or power to do that. I mean, Brian, would you like to take that?
What you've said is absolutely correct. But when we say we don't have the power, Britain certainly hasn't got the power.
Yeah, that's what
Not only have we not got the troops, so the British Army at the moment is, in theory, capable of putting 20,000 men into the field for a very limited time. This is nothing. This is not, if we go back to the Second World War, and we've got armies, 200,000 men, multiple armies trying to attack Russia. And we're capable as a nation now of putting 20,000 men into the field for a very limited period of time. We're not making our own ammunition. We're not making the munitions. We haven't got the supply chains. And what Ukraine has demonstrated is neither is NATO. So the war, this limited war, it's still a limited war in Ukraine, has shown that not even the combined might of the American military and Dutch industrial complex, plus the whole combined might of the British European military industrial complex, we cannot provide enough ammunition, munitions, equipment to fight the war in Ukraine. We haven't got the troops, Germans at the moment, busy talking about ramping up the biggest army in Europe. Well, that's all very well, but that takes time to train the troops. And as Ben's touched on, the war in Ukraine is now a very special war because with the drone technology, this is a war that's never been fought in this way before. And the bad news for Britain and the EU and the States is the Russians are proving very, very adept at using drone technology, which is why they are continuing to advance on the front. So Russia has demonstrated that it can outfight the combined might, conventional might of the US and NATO at the moment. It's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And this has been a huge shock to the West. So I find it incredible that we've got our politicians talking as if we're going to go to war when they know, at least Healy knows, that we have not got the troops or the military capability to do this. We haven't got the men, we haven't got the equipment, we haven't got the training, we haven't got the logistics. And so I really do wonder what we're dealing with, mad people. That they seem unhinged because they're talking, they're talking to the media, or they're putting out tweets about what they're going to do, or there's little film clips going up, but they're not in the real world. We're incapable of engaging with this, and the Russians know it, which is why at the moment Putin seems very relaxed wherever he appears, and well he might, because it's clear that the European Union has failed as a united military concept. NATO has failed, and Trump is even telling the American population, we can't do this and look after the Chinese. But I think we're dealing with politicians. What's happened to them? They've been reframed, possibly. but they are not actually in the real world. These people are not, they're not capable of grasping what's going on around them. They seem to be believing their own reality. That's the scary bit.
Right. So in a way that's encouraging, but because it means that they're not as smart as we might fear they are. But obviously there's a danger there as well, that they'll just do silly things or do crazy things. With regard to Russia and our inability to defeat them in this altercation, is that not because the Western powers are holding back because they don't want Russia to declare war on them, and then that becomes their own countries getting bombed, a possible world war? Is that not why they're holding back, or is it that they literally just don't have the resources or manpower to give?
Well, in my opinion, in the first instance, it's because they haven't got it. I mean, if you go back to the Cold War, which is my military service vintage, I was there in that period, and at that time, NATO was US, UK. That was the driving force, and all the other nations, there may be some upset people from what I'm about to say, but all the other nations were regarded as secondary. There was a pecking order. So Dutch units, quite highly regarded, German units, quite highly regarded, Italians somewhere after that. But essentially, it was always US, UK that was driving the procedure. And many of the big Cold War exercises were specifically about running convoys, just as with the Second World War, convoys across the Atlantic to allow the American military industrial complex to supply ammunition and all the logistic supply requirements, and to ultimately resupply them. And you were talking about exercises with hundreds of ships and transport ships at sea in order to get this stuff into a battle zone in the European Union. We've now got a fight in Ukraine right at the far eastern end of Europe, and the logistics train does not exist. The ability to produce tanks and weapons does not exist. The military industrial complex has done a brilliant job over many years in the West saying how good it is. We produce the best planes, we produce the best ships, we produce the best missiles. Not only was that not true, the West did not have the capability to produce weapons and ammunition and missiles in the quantity that would be necessary in a major conflict. Russia has demonstrated that in the background it's developed that ability, but we don't have it. So the reality is that the US and NATO, or the European Union, however you want to package it, is not capable of getting the size of forces onto the ground in Ukraine to deal with the Russians. The Russians are only partially mobilized. They're not the whole of Russia is not on a war footing. It's on a partially mobilized footing. And now, as Ben says, the Russians have been fighting for 2 years. They have got absolute frontline fighting experience. They're battle-hardened troops. And the reality is, when you put fresh troops up against battle-hardened troops, you're going to take huge losses in those fresh troops. This is what happened to the Americans in Western Europe in the Second World War. So there's been hype about the power of NATO, and now it's coming home to roost because they simply can't deliver it.
But it's been going on for nearly 4 years now. It'll be in February, it will be 4 years since this started. And some would say that, I mean, you say that Russia's only partially mobilized, but you could argue that Russia is also not I mean, on it, some would say that Russia is also not that powerful because it's taken 4 years so far and it still hasn't taken Ukraine.
Well,
what would you say to that?
Well, I come back onto that instantly and say Russia is not fighting Ukraine. Russia has been fighting Ukrainian troops supported by the full might of the United States and NATO and a few other hanging on countries. Russia is not fighting Ukraine. It is fighting at the moment the whole of the NATO system, because it's the whole of that NATO system that's pumping in the arms and the ammunition and the missile systems and everything else. And despite NATO with the US putting in as much as it can, Russia is destroying it and is continuing to move forward. But the pace is slow on the battlefield because contrary to all the reports that the BBC or Defence HQ, our MOD propaganda machine, is constantly saying that the Russians are throwing waves of troops against the Ukrainians on the battlefield, and those troops are being slaughtered in high numbers. The exact opposite is true. The Russians are taking ground by the use of drones in a way that's never been seen before, and very, very small squads of men, often three or four men, are moving on the ground to take over areas. It's like a lava flow moving, and the Russians are not bringing huge armoured columns in, because anybody that's moving armour on that battlefield is taking losses, including the Russians. But if you look at the front altogether, you're talking 900, 1,000 kilometre front. This is Second World War scale battle, which the Russians said, we're not invading, we're conducting a special military operation. And they were serious about that because they are using a relatively small number of troops and they are defeating the combined might of the US and NATO. It's a phenomenal performance and nobody wants to talk about it because actually for the West, it's very scary.
All right. Okay, well, let's move on from that to another topic, which Ben wrote down, which is the attack, and this is a complete switch of, so sorry if it's abrupt, the attack on men and women. Ben, what did you mean by that?
Well, that came from Brian, actually, but I will just speak on it briefly. I mean, there's the obvious culture war stuff, right? So this idea that men have been under attack culturally, politically, rhetorically, everywhere over the past 10, 15, 20 years, and it's really ramped up recently and it's getting worse. You know, you can't turn on the TV without hearing talk of the manosphere and all the awful thing that these nasty far-right men might talk to your children about, and we've got to censor them and lock them down and all that kind of stuff. You know, so that's a relatively recent development, but it comes on the back of, what, a century plus of feminist thought and political organisation. And, you know, my view is that even going that far back, you're looking at a deliberate process of division and destabilisation of the country, basically. And actually, if you want a well-functioning society, you want a civilization, you want something that lasts, yeah, like intergenerationally, then you need peaceful coexistence and collaboration, so far as that is possible, between men and women. It's a partnership. Yeah, everything comes from that. Literally, right? You know, like the family unit as the base unit.
Oh, yeah, it's the bedrock.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's common sense would tell anyone.
Exactly. So all of these attacks on men or women, but it's coming back the other way now, right? So there was this clip there was a Nick Fuentes interview with Piers Morgan like a week ago, and Piers Morgan plays this clip to Fuentes, and he says something like, women just need to shut the hell up. And Piers Morgan challenges him on this, and he says, yeah, it's true. And I'm just thinking, yeah, Fuentes, I'm not going to get into what exactly I think about him, but that's just stupid. You sound stupid. You can't just say women need to shut the hell up. Like, you sound like an adolescent, right? Like, in order for us to be an effective society, a flourishing and prosperous society like we should want to be, then proper integration, understanding, coexistence between the masculine and the feminine, men and women, is absolutely at the heart of that. So anything that messes with it is bad news. But Brian's been doing a lot of looking into this. That actually came from him, but that was my opening gambit.
Okay. And of course, this was the year of the adolescence drama. I think it was Netflix.
Yes.
Which, well, I won't comment on that. Brian, what's your take on the...
Ben, for coming in, this is the angle. If we were talking about the state of the nation, and for me, the moment you take the view that we are being attacked by our own government, lots of policies fall into place where people are saying, was that a cock-up? Was it conspiracy? What was it? But you look at what's happening across the board, we are seeing breakdown right the way across the constitutional structure of the country. And to me, the moment you allow your brain to say, yep, this is not accidental, we are being attacked by our own government, as Mike touched on as well, things start to make sense. But what's the most important thing, which Ben's just stated, is the relation men and women, the identity of men and women. So particularly for women now, we've what state we've got that you're a woman, but you're going to have to share your toilets and your changing rooms and your showers with a man who's calling himself a woman. I mean, this is outrageous. It's such an insult on what it is to be a woman and what the valuable attributes of a woman are. So we've had this massive, massive attack on women. We've had the feminist attack, which means that women have been taught to feel that if they want to be a mother and bring up a strong generation of children and work with a husband to produce a really strong marriage or a partnership, if they don't want to be a chief executive, they should feel ashamed because they should be out there climbing through the glass ceiling in order to become a man. So all of these policies, feminism, and then we've got the woke bit on top of that, and in contrast we've got the feminization of men. So men are not allowed to have male characteristics. Men have got to become more female, and they've certainly got to be more subservient to the needs of the female. So this is vicious stuff. And what is it ultimately? What's it ultimately done? It's broken down the marriages and the partnerships, the stable marriages and the partnerships, which should be producing the next generation of stable, capable children. Now, one of the little clues that we picked up on a couple of weeks ago was the Chancellor, Miss Reeves, was getting a lot of very good press because she was going to increase the benefits for additional children, above two children. But when her claim was that probably 450,000 additional children were going to be brought out of poverty by the government paying out these benefits. But when you go to look at the families the benefits will go to, it becomes very interesting because then you start to look at the statistics of single parent families, 3.2 million of them, of which 1.7 million, I think I'm correct in those statistics, are single mothers. And of course, in a single mother household, there is no father as a role model for the boy. So there's some very damaging characteristics, but for the Chancellor, if she could throw money into these damaged into these households, what was she going to do? Well, apparently it was going to help bring the children out of poverty, But in reality, it's not. It's actually just going to help them get by a little bit above poverty. What's really needed is for the women is a male in that household to be the father and also bringing in the resources, bringing in the income, that they're not a family in poverty. But nobody wants to look at this. And so what's going to happen on top of that? We've now got the fact that they're announcing that there's going to be a 10-year plan to reduce violence attacks, sexual attacks on women. And what did the BBC demonstrate very quickly? That one of the key parts of the action plan was that young males, boys at school, were going to be reframed, retrained in all matters to become more pro-female. In fact, the headline in the BBC today is about boys getting classes in schools on misogyny. So the state is now absolutely going for the minds of the young boys. How are they going to grow up? They're going to grow up fearful of the females, because if they say the wrong thing and do the wrong thing, they're going to have broken this rule. So the state is now putting an even bigger divide between men and women. But of course, the women ultimately are going to suffer most, because if the women can't get a partner, they are going to continue to live in poverty or on the poverty threshold. So yeah. It's pieces of a jigsaw. So it's sold as a positive thing. We're going to take children out of poverty by paying these benefits. But when you get into the real detail and look at what's happening, the state is actually attacking those families, and they're certainly attacking the minds of the children.
Yeah. And certainly it will, as you say, reduce the number of boys who grow up with a father figure, which in turn fractures their sense of masculinity and their understanding of how to be a man. You used the phrase twice, or I think Ben used it as well, that the state, the British state, is attacking its own people and undermining, deconstructing them. Mike, what's going on? If the British state is attacking its own people, but also setting us up for a war that we can't win, what is the British state doing? And as you said about Afghanistan, all of that as well. So what is going on? What is the actual situation behind? Like, if a state is going to weaken and attack its own people, but then make huge demands of them abroad and internationally, that seems completely insane.
I think they're demonstrating their insanity on a daily basis. But look, the point I wanted to make on this is because relationships have broken down between men and women, there's an economic impact on this. Of course, it means that there's competition in the workplace between men and women for roles, and women are being, there's positive discrimination going on to get women into high paying or high flying jobs over men. But there's a physical reality effect of that, which is that, you know, you were talking about boys not having, Brian was talking about boys not having father role models. But the point is, we're not having boys and we're not having girls anymore, because people can't afford to have children anymore, because we've created this economy for ourselves where they're basically aren't enough, you know, the jobs aren't paying enough for single parent families to survive. So they're reliant on taxpayer money for in some form of benefit. But even the family, even where a family is, there is a woman and a man together or in a relationship, they're either not having children at the appropriate age because they can't afford to do it, or they're not having children at all. And so this, of course, is also driving inward migration, because employers are demanding that people are able to come into the country and work. And, you know, earlier we were talking about the migration of Afghanis and irregular migration and whatnot, but irregular migration is a relatively small proportion of the total number of people that have come into the country in the last 10 or 20 years. So the impact of this breakdown in relationship between men and women has ramifications which are affecting us for generations to come, because we don't have a birth rate which is actually capable of replacing the population. Now, I don't know what age you are, but I'm in my 50s. Brian's a little bit older than I am. Certainly by the time I'm Brian's age or a bit older, I'm going to be looking at the situation with care homes and whatnot, and I'm going to be saying to myself, well, who's going to be staffing these care homes when I'm at an age where I might need that facility at some point in the future? Because it's not going to be somebody that necessarily was born in this country or that I grew up beside. It's not somebody that's necessarily going to have any empathy with me as an older person in this country, because we're not replacing our own population. And lots of Western countries, I mean, that is a problem right across the world, admittedly, but we're not, the impact of this breakdown in relationships is tangible. It's something real for our future. And that needs to be kept in mind as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. Feminism has destroyed so much of our social fabric and our social systems, so that we're no longer replacing our own population. And that means that in turn, other systems are suffering, like care homes. So then we have to import, well, we're told that we have to import people from the rest of the world to look after, in nurseries, schools, but also at the other end of life, the care homes. But then those people will not have the same links and empathy with us that our own kind would have, inevitably and demonstrably they don't. So it seems to be a situation where, on the face of it, the British state has committed itself to feminism at some point, let's say 1945, and no matter what bad effects come from that, the state cannot or will not go back on that commitment. No matter what damage it does and demonstrable damage it does, that must be adhered to. Feminism must be adhered to and expanded to the point where even this very year, when the country is already in a parlous state, they're introducing even more of it. Wanting every schoolboy to watch Adolescence. So again, we come back to this question: what is the actual game plan here? Because you can't do that to a people, to a nation, and then make huge demands of it militarily. So I guess what I'm asking is, what does the British state or those in control of it actually want? Do they want really an army of Africans invading Russia and taking it over? And they've just got to get rid of the native British population first. I mean, no, what's actually going on?
I think Ukraine's the meat grinder. That's where all the native Europeans will be sent to die. And then, in exactly the same way that we've heard from Ukraine over the past few months, well, now that all those people are dead, we're going to have loads of immigration from sub-Saharan Africa to replace those bodies with other bodies. And they're just bodies, you know, because none of the sort of blood and soil and ancient culture stuff, that doesn't matter. They're just economic units. And that appears to be the kind of game plan across the whole of the West at the moment. Same in the US, really, you know, they're maybe less far along in certain ways, more further along in others. I don't know. But if you look at France, I think is probably the most pronounced. You know, if you look at where the French are now, I think they're probably about 5, maybe even 10 years ahead of us in terms of that process. But yeah, that seems to be the game plan. And ultimately, to answer your question, it's democide, right? It's state murder. It's the deliberate destruction of people's ethnicities, ancient cultures, because they're inconvenient to the purposes of power and profit.
All right. Amongst all that, we'll move on to another topic. I don't think we're going to get through even a fraction of the topics that you mentioned, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. But there is another one that's of interest to me just now, especially, which is the, as you said, the accelerating collapse of the left versus right paradigm. Greens versus Reform at the next election, and who's actually pulling the strings of Farage and Zach Polanski. So let's... There are several layers to this. The first is the sort of intellectual or ideological layer of left versus right. And then there's the more prosaic layer of Reform versus Greens, what's actually going on in the real world. So which of you would like to take this first?
Well, I wrote it down, so maybe I'll have a pop. So this actually links into the male and female question, right? So the way I understand left and right wing is actually left is more feminine, and it's not women and men and women, it's feminine and masculine, right? So the left is more feminine, and it's more, and within that you then get all these messages about compassion and empathy and understanding and creativity and all that kind of thing. And then the right is more hierarchical and rigid and inflexible, you know, like in their extremes. And then if you go to the hard left, then you end up in total entropy, breakdown, and collapse. And if you stay on the hard right, then everything just becomes completely rigid and stagnant and inflexible. And actually, in a well-functioning society, you need a blend between the two. In the same way that you need a blend between men and women, the masculine and the feminine, the same is true with the political spectrum. And, you know, if you think about it in the terms of conservative and progressive, if we were purely progressive, that would mean that we would throw everything that from the past out. And that would be crazy, because then you're saying that there's nothing from the past that has any value. But if you were purely conservative, then you were saying, well, we can't possibly ever improve upon what we've already got now, which is also not true. So again, you need a mix between those two things. And because you need it, that's why we're consistently presented with the idea that you have to have only one or the other. And that's completely baked into the discourse across the piece. And it's just been reinforced. You know, we've moved from the Tory or the Torah party. I quite like that from that article. David Cameron said the Conservatives should be called the Torah party. So you've got the Torah party and Labour, which would be conservative and progressive. But now they've kind of been swept out of the way. The Conservatives basically self-destructed. I think that was probably deliberate. And then Labour, I think actually what Starmer's doing right now is the deliberate destruction of the Labour Party. And they're going to sweep the slate clean. And then we're going to, instead of those two that have done us proud for a couple hundred years, we're then going to be lumped with Greens on the progressive side and Reform on the conservative side, even though Reform doesn't actually mean conservative. So I think they've completely removed the conservative option. And this is all we're fed day to day. And it's going right the way from the top level of politics all the way down to the street protests that we've been seeing around the country. It's the same thing, you know?
So basically Labour is going to be replaced with the Green Party.
I think
and
so.
The Conservative Party with the Reform Party.
I believe so. I mean, I'm not. I don't claim to have a crystal ball. And as you say, like Badenoch seems to be resurgent at the dispatch box and all that kind of thing. And they'll keep their options open, I'm sure. But it strikes me that the main thrust of the discourse, not necessarily in the media, but like actually on a street level, or you know, you talk to your uncle down the pub, whatever it might be. There's the kind of the man on the street is kind of Reform, or thinks that Farage could be a solution. And then the kind of Gen Z, metropolitan, liberal, university educated, and then also the kind of annoying metropolitan, liberal, Stoke Newington type people. They're all diehard Polanski fans for some reason, but I think he's a total charlatan, but maybe we can dig into that in a minute.
Okay. Mike or Brian, would you like to chime in on this before we get to Zach Polanski? The collapse of left versus right.
The collapse of it. Well, I think I'd have to say that my eye has always been on Nigel Farage, because as somebody who was involved with UKIP in the very early days, Nigel Farage, I have always described as a Pied Piper. He can give the rousing speeches. He starts speaking and you can see him win over people. I've been in halls many times when he's been speaking, and you see the people absolutely loving it. So he comes out with all the right words and the razzmatazz, and he gets people all feeling excited, but he never actually takes them anywhere. And if you look at what he did to UKIP at the stage that UKIP was starting to make real progress at local authority level, the local elections, that's where you need your baseline. When they were having their biggest success, he starts to walk away. And then we get the statement at one thing that he was worried about the plane crash. And he said, I'm going to move away from politics. And then a month later or so, he was on the stage with Trump. So he's a Pied Piper butterfly, and he never, ever gets to grips with the real issues. And I can imagine might be some people in the audience getting a bit hot under the collar with this, but if you take immigration, he'll talk about the rubber boats, but he won't talk about the actual immigration policies that are allowing the number of people to come into the country legitimately. That's where the bulk of the problem is. The overwhelming bulk of the problem on immigration, on migration, is the people who the doors have been opened to allow them to come in legally. And as we touched on earlier on, what's been happening overseas that's driving this movement or exodus of people that are coming out of one country and they want to come to UK. But Farage doesn't get to grips with this. And so to me, he stays in the political arena being the Pied Piper, making people think that in the future there's going to be a party that is going to deal with all the fraud and corruption and breakdown of society, but actually he's never going to deal with it. So I know I've come a little bit out of the left right, but you've mentioned Nigel Farage, and I think he deserves special treatment because he's the light. He attracts the people to the light, but then nothing happens to deal with the real problem of the corruption in the whole of the political system.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I think he's been that way since the start. And I first perceived it about 5-6 years ago, and you've known it for a lot longer than that. I think there is also something to be said about, in intellectual terms, the collapse of left versus right. But I think that's nascent just now. I think it's a bit too early to talk about it, except speculatively. Mike, would you have anything to say about reform and the Green Party? I think the Green Party is being pushed artificially. I think Zach Polanski is being pushed artificially. They're making a far bigger deal of him than they need to be, in theory. But then the left have said the same thing about Nigel Farage, that he's got more TV coverage than many other politicians over the last 10, 15 years. So the left would say that Farage is being artificially propped up and inflated. What's your perspective on all of
that? Yeah, I got to skip that question, because I think actually Ben is the best person to answer that. This is more his bag. So Ben, why don't you take that one?
On Farage and Zelensky, yes. Not Zelensky, Polanski. So I'm getting my Anskis mixed up.
Did I say Zelensky?
No, I think I did. I'm misspeaking. they're both being artificially inflated. But they're there to give people false hope that there is a political solution to the problems in the country. There is no political solution, certainly not in Westminster. And this idea that some you know, heroic figure, if we can call Farage a heroic figure or Polanski a heroic figure, is going to come along and like magically wave a wand and fix all the problems of the country and you know, that's and it's all going to be done for you by someone else, and someone else is going to pay for it, importantly, particularly if you're on the left. It's just fantasy land, basically. And they use you know, I think they're sort of these ultimate archetypes now, because Farage, he's got this, you know, boorish little Englander thing with his Union Jack toe caps on his shoes, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's just custom designed to enrage anyone of the kind of progressive liberal lefty type persuasion. And then Polanski is just absurd, you know. He's kind of come out of nowhere. The man is quite literally a trained hypnotist, and I actually feel like he's got swathes of the population in a trance at the moment. If you look at the way he delivers his lines, he says things with such glib confidence. There's this one he keeps on saying at the moment, which is, the country wants a wealth tax. And everyone sits there and they all go, yeah, the country wants it. And I'm thinking, the country doesn't want that. But you're brainwashing into this idea. You're not saying what is actually the case, which is that this is highly controversial and it's probably not going to do what we think it's going to do. And there's other ways that we could approach the problem. You're saying, the country wants this.
Yeah, you know? This is like what Tony Blair used to do, where he would act as if something is just a foregone conclusion. It's all, the debate's already been had. There's no, we've just got to do it now.
Yeah, exactly. And then I don't know what the reforms economic policies are, but if you listen to Polanski talking about economics for him, I mean, it's kind of obvious, really, given the fact, I mean, they're basically, Green is essentially, they're communist, you know. It's a fancy 2025 version of communism, but it's all neo-Marxist. You scratch beneath the surface and they're communitarian, redistribution of wealth, destruction of capital, nationalization of industries. But then it's all tied into this kind of green transformation agenda as well. So like a couple of weeks ago, he was saying, oh, well, our national debt is a trillion. I think it might be more than that, actually. We could treble that. And that's how we could fix the economy, by taking out 2 trillion more in debt. And he sort of, and his followers are going, yeah, let's do that. And you're sitting there thinking, you're insane. That's like saying you should be using your credit card to pay the rent. Are you talking about?
And there seems to be a precursor to Zach Polanski in Gary Stevenson,
yes,
who was saying similar sort of student union sixth form politics in a grown man.
Yes, right, and there's I've no doubt that's a coordinated effort, because it's like, oh look, Gary's here, the former city trader who's going to educate us all on politics, who just happens to have done his master's at the LSE, by the way. So he's probably a Fabian. I don't know if he actually is, but he's come from that world. And you just listen to him talk, and he has one idea, right? Literally one idea. And his idea is to take money from people who have it so that he can have it instead and do things that he wants with it. And it's all done via the state, obviously. But then if you actually just run some basic numbers, if you look at the Sunday Times Rich List, the top 350 wealthiest people in the country and the wealthiest families, so that's all of the billionaires and a significant number of the high-digit multimillionaires in the country, their total combined wealth is about £800 billion. And if you took all of that, not just taxed a little bit of it, which is what they're saying, if you took all of it, that would fund the government at the current rate of spend for about 7 months. And then there wouldn't be any more billionaires to tax. There wouldn't be any more millionaires to tax, or maybe some millionaires, but you know what I mean, right? And but and, yeah. And so what they're doing, and he's like, oh, well, we'll just do a 1% on assets. It's like, yeah, but the thing is, you'll take that, you'll burn it in about a week, and then you go, oh, well, let's do that again. And then we'll do it again, and then we'll do it again. And essentially what you'll end up with is the whole country will just be deflated, and they'll be standing in the wreckage of what used to be a great civilization. Polanski and Gary will be sitting on top of the ruins, basically. It's a nightmare. Yeah. It's an absolute nightmare. And they're only able to do this because people are just very naive and economically illiterate, a lot of people. And they think that there are just easy options where, oh, someone else will pay for it and someone else will do it for me and then that'll fix the problem. And it just won't. It just won't.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll get to the super chats now because I'd love to have tackled the other put the other topics to you, but there just isn't time. Chief Noticer said, these guys are genuinely brilliant. Keep up the good work.
So, oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's nice of you to say. And let me see Rumble, because there were several on Rumble. Let me just get to that. Ghost Dog Man gave $2. Thank you very much. Okay, Pleb Lordy said, are any of you aware of Timothy Winters, the Cambridge Muslim College, and their combination of perennial traditionalism and British Islam? They are quite impressive, sadly. Timothy Winters and the Cambridge Muslim College. Any of you know about this? I think I've heard of Timothy Winters, but I don't know anything about it, I'm afraid.
I now have a new thing to research, is what I'll say to that. That sounds fascinating.
All right. Okay. Well, in that case, we'll end this one here. This is, I always think I should do a longer stream with UK Column each year. It always ends up like this, where there's so much more to be said and explored, but there just isn't time. So maybe we'll do something different next year. Okay. Well, let's end this one here. Brian, I'll give you the closing line on UK Column, where people can find it, what they'll find there, and so forth. Brian.
Thank you for that. Absolutely encourage people to go to ukcolumn.org for the main website. All of the news programs that we do are streamed live. The interviews that go out, so that's Monday, Wednesday and Friday, and Tuesday and Thursday there's normally an interview, is streamed live at 1 o'clock, plus all of that information goes up on the website. So there is a fantastic archive of our previous news editions on the main UK Column website, and if people are interested in a particular topic, they are researching a topic, go to the UK Column website and put your topic into our search bar by the little magnifying glass, because inevitably articles or news reports on that topic will come up. And I'm saying this with confidence because we're coming up to 20 years in the game. We've got a huge amount of information on that website, plus an awful lot of hundreds of articles on various subjects as well, and all of that is on the website. Now we're also on YouTube. A few months ago we had our main original YouTube account reinstalled, so that one's available. We've also got the updated YouTube website, which is UK Column News, which people can go and look at. Mike, I'll defer to you for the other social media streams that people can go to look for information on.
Oh, well, I mean, there's not much to add. Obviously, X and Odyssey and so on. But, you know, the website is really where we would encourage people to go as a first stop.
Yep.
All right. Okay, well, in that case, we will end it there. Again, sorry that it's been truncated, but it's just the format of Millennial demands this. So maybe next year we'll do something different. All right. Thank you, Brian, Ben, and Mike from UK Column. I'll be back very soon, maybe 5 minutes, with the next interview. In the meantime, UK Column, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.